Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes, copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author reviewed the history of both the people and the dogs that have inhabited her land over time. We resume Suburban Safari on page 151, and this is episode 15. Chapter 8, The Stately and Scheming Trees. A glint of penny-colored fur catches my eye. Lightning stripes give it away. It's Cheeky the Chipmunk, popping across the grass to his hole. Something protrudes from his mouth. My baby found an acorn, all on his own. I've been worrying about Cheeky's diet. I read that sunflower seeds are the equivalent of junk food for chipmunks, but I can't convince him that other foods have much merit. I thought that when the weather cooled, his little body might demand more serious nutriment. The only thing that changed was his work schedule. Instead of pittering into the house at 8 a.m., he turns up at 9, then 9:30. On an overcast day, his claws might not hit my knee until 11. But there he is now, working independently and diversifying his diet. I look out my office window later in the day to discover him at eye level, 20 feet up in the choke cherry tree. I miss the opportunity to smooth his lightning stripes and smell the herbs in his fur, and I hate to see him bopping around in the open, exposed to cats and hawks. His path to the indoor seed dish is shielded by shrubbery. Still, I'm glad he's able to break a habit when instinct hollers at him. I'm also proud that he's able to find acorns in a year when the oak trees are making a coordinated effort to starve him out. They really are. It's not accidental that the acorn crop is piddling. The trees have put their crowns together and decided to thin the rodent population. Throughout the neighborhood, and perhaps throughout New England, oak trees are holding back. Each tree is producing a minimal number of acorns. Some are producing none at all. As a result, the deer, bears, squirrel, and birds that depend on acorns are planning famine-sized little families, or none at all. If every single acorn is devoured by hungry critters this year, the trees can tolerate that. They have decades to reproduce, and one of these years, when the acorn eaters are trimmed down to size, the trees will wink, nod, and dump down a monster crop. The diminished animal population will be unable to harvest them all. When I heard about this masting strategy, I found it suspect. Are we to believe trees have a secret communication system, or an OPEC-style acorn cartel? But judging from nascent research, it's simpler than that. The trees have evolved to respond to weather. A certain pattern of drought and heat presses the right chemical buttons in the trees, and they go nuts with the acorns. Evolution rewarded the trees that chanced to participate in the cycle. Trees around the world have evolved to respond to various weather patterns. Trees in eastern North America, for instance, synchronize their fruiting clocks to an early summer drought. The next year, they let fly. Cooperation between different species also varies from one area to another. In an extreme case of synchrony, almost 400 different species of trees in Borneo rely on a cue from El Niño, whereupon they all bombard the seed-eating boar, orangutans, parakeets, and people with a storm of seed. Compliance with this starve-em strategy isn't perfect. My friend Deb, who lives half a mile west of me, has been made sleepless this year by the clang of acorns on her car. Her driveway is paved in yellow pulp. Her tree is masting this year, and damn the consequences. Perhaps it's a mutant, or perhaps its genes that respond to its personal water or food situation overpowered its genes that act for the greater good. This happens in wild forests, too. Not every tree plays along, but enough of them do so that synchronized masting works. In the interest of full disclosure, this predator satiation theory isn't the only one on the menu. One competing hypothesis argues that the trees produced high mast after they've been perfectly fed and watered. Another says that trees who depend on wind for pollination need their comrades to be in bloom at the same time so that they can cross-pollinate, and that pollination drove evolution toward synchrony. I wouldn't be surprised if all three factors play a part. But I also wouldn't blame the oaks if their primary objective was to defeat the acorn stealers. In a low-mast year like this, my red oak might produce a few hundred acorns. Each has the potential to become a new oak tree. None is likely to succeed. An acorn is an attractive package of calories, low in protein but high in fat. An ark's worth of animals await their ripening each year. The 150 species of acorn burglars include acorn weevils, mice, blue jays, woodpeckers, turkeys, foxes, feral pigs, deer, and bears. In the suburbs and cities, birds and small rodents are the hardiest eaters. Of all these, only a few pay for their meal. Squirrels and jays bury an acorn in a way that maximizes the nut's chance of germinating. These critters intend to dig up the nuts later, but if they forget or die, the oak benefits. By contrast, the weevils, the deer, the woodpeckers, and the bears either chew up the nuts on the spot or stow them in tree cavities or rain gutters where they can't grow. The truth is that suburbanites are happy to have squirrels and weevils constrain oak fecundity. When we desire another oak tree, we'll go buy one and put it where we want it. But my tree's genes urge it to reproduce, so it soldiers on. The masting strategy generates unexpected ripples through an ecosystem beyond regulating the squirrel population. A recent investigation found that a high mast year results in a higher population of deer and mice. In turn, that produces a bloom of ticks that carry Lyme disease. On the other hand, a low mast year trims the population of mice who eat gypsy moth pupae. So an acorn shortage can lead to a gypsy moth surplus. Nature is complicated. The other trees in the yard are having as lean a year as the oaks. The few apples that the orioles spared would benefit if someone ate them and then excreted their seeds wrapped in a blob of fertilizer. The fruits advertise their sweetening flesh by replacing green camouflage with reds and yellows. But there are no takers. The apples rot where they fall. The sumac trees are barren, too. Thousands of rose chafer beetles held an orgy in the blossoms earlier in the summer, devouring every flower. Not one berry materializes. Oh well, a tree has patience. They're embattled organisms, my trees. Their fruits are stolen, and day after day their leaves are eaten alive. They're absolutely crawling with herbivores who want a piece of them. I climb a stepladder into my oak and perch among the low branches. At first glance, the leaves are a rich forest green laced with bright veins that put me in mind of lighted highways seen from an airplane at night. The same principle creates both patterns, I suppose. A main artery divides and divides again to deliver resources to the humblest town or leaf cell. Subtle motions draw my attention. On leaf surfaces, white animalcules the size of salt grains move about. Are they eating leaf or eating mold that's eating leaf exudate? A glittering little fly I think of as a greenie is gliding across leaf after leaf in search of aphids. A small orange spider hangs in a web she has stretched across a rosette of leaves. I swat a mosquito and try to make a gift to the spider, but either my looming hand or the mosquito corpse terrifies her and she plunges down on an escape thread. The mosquito revives and kicks free. The spider returns. Out at the end of a branch is a Zippytown ant a mid-sized brown gal. She's hunting, exploring every twig she encounters. She has commuted 12 feet up the trunk and another 10 to the end of the branch in her quest for food. If I can spot this many animals on a single branch of the oak, imagine how many others are scuttling around me. This tree is a world unto itself, a skyscraper bustling with insect industry. A catbird alights 6 feet away, chattering full tilt. His gray chest heaves. He catches sight of me through the leaves and claps his bill shut. He peers with one black eye, then tilts his head and peers with the other, then flies off. The oak leaves, on close inspection, are battle-weary. I count the bite marks and holes on a few of them. The average number of insults per leaf is 350. Every leaf in my sight is battered. Some are gnawed right to the spine. Every leaf stem has been chewed, too, and scarred with black measles. The tree is being eaten alive. Unlike animals, trees can't get up and run when an enemy approaches. And my 50-foot oak can't hide. It's a rooted tower of food. Back in May, when its leaves were pale green stars, they were irresistible. In the woods, deer and rabbits would have made short work of any low foliage, but those animals are absent from my yard. Instead, the shiny leaves were nibbled by squirrels. As the leaves toughened, the tree was invaded by a horde of insects. Gall-making wasps and mites deposited eggs on leaf and twig, inspiring the tree to grow an edible uterus of oak cells. On the leaves, a splendid array of beetles, flies, moths, and wasps left eggs that produced young leaf miners. These larvae spent their days tunneling between the upper and lower surfaces of the oak leaves, their paths drying to brown squiggles. Even under the bark, a beige oak borer larva awoke and resumed his conversion of hardwood to sawdust. Tiny gypsy moth larvae chewed holes in the new leaves. As they grew and molted, they ate bigger holes. My oak tree didn't take the herbivore attack lying down. To experience its first line of defense, I take a few bites of oak leaf myself. It's hard to find one that still has a bite-sized section free of holes, bumps, and brown scars. And for good measure, I wash the leaf. Then I snip out a nice section and chew. Initially, the flavor is powerfully green and not odious, but as the leaf turns to mush, it turns bitter. It's not puckery, nothing like a dandelion. There's a nice note of black tea. What's bothersome, though, the reason I wouldn't serve steamed oak leaves as a side dish, is that it does something to my saliva. My spit thickens, I think. It feels super slippery, and the inside of my mouth feels a little weird. Maybe it's time to try an acorn. I find a nice one, with no tooth marks or weevil holes. I pry off the cap and wash the nut. I don't want to introduce the confusing symptoms of botulism to my experiment. Oops, didn't notice the weevil hole. That one's black and punky inside, as is the next one, and the next. Well, I've been foiled by a low-mast year. Weevils can get almost every acorn in a slim year. They must have missed a few because the squirrels got some, and they won't take breached nuts. But between rodents and insects, no acorns are left for me. I do remember biting into them in my childhood, and the memory is of a desiccating bitterness. Both the leaves and fruit of an oak tree are drenched in tannin compounds. Tannins taste nasty, but that's not their best feature. As I chewed up the plant cells, little packets of tannin broke and mixed with the pulp. Tannin molecules sought out nutritious protein molecules in the leaf pulp and bonded with them. My body would have a hard time absorbing those altered molecules. I suppose that reaction also altered the texture of my saliva. And perhaps that alteration cued me to spit the stuff out. I had hoped to swallow the mush to see what happened. but the reptilian portion of my brain may have interpreted my spit thickening as a warning of indigestibility. It simply refused to let me swallow. I doubt the oak leaf would have hurt me. Some insects do grow slower when they feed on high tannin vegetation, however. While that's not a fatal blow, it's a stealthy strategy on the part of the tree. Slowed growth forces larvae to spend longer feeding, which exposes them to birds and other predators. Ha! Now, if tannins deter some feeding, why don't oak trees produce more of them and scare off every diner? For one thing, making tannins burns a tree's energy, energy that could be channeled into acorns. For another, a tannic acorn may offend an acorn weevil, but it will also offend a squirrel. Squirrels will accept high tannin acorns in lean times, but they prefer mild ones. If an oak tree gets too heavy-handed with the tannins, the squirrels, who plant its acorns, may patronize a sweeter tree. The oak must use its defenses judiciously to maintain congenial relations with its seed-planting partners. Plants who need no help with their seeds are free to be meaner. The milkweed that grows near my raspberries, for instance, uses wind to distribute its seeds. Accordingly, it can deploy a nastier chemical designed to jangle the nervous system of its attackers. The white sap in milkweed not only tastes bitter, it also contains alkaloid chemicals that can give an insect a heart attack. Even animals as big as cows occasionally overdose on milkweed. The dose makes the poison, however, and human beings have learned to love many plant alkaloids in measured amounts. Tobacco plants make alkaloids. Coffee trees do, too. Poppies and coca plants gush alkaloids. We intentionally extract those chemicals to jangle our nervous systems. Nicotine, caffeine, morphine, and cocaine are among the most entrancing chemicals we know. The pine trees in my yard subscribe to another common class of chemical weapons, the terpenes. Some terpenes kill a feeding insect outright. Others scramble a larva's development by sterilizing it, destroying its appetite, or making it molt prematurely. As with alkaloids, people have found ways to harness terpenes. Pines give us turpentine, pine oil, and rosin. We use camphor for the same thing the camphor tree does, to repel insects. From mint, we get the terpene menthol. The soapwort I used to wash my hands when I was investigating my lawn herbs uses its soapy terpenes to poison a host of beetles, mites, and moth and butterfly larvae, and so on. Most plants have more than one chemical defense. Tannins turn up in many plants, as do the soapy chemicals. Some of my plants also rely on mechanical defenses. The oak, in addition to its tannic bite, offers wood and leaves that are toughened by nutrition-free fiber and lignin. If an animal spends more calories chewing its meal than it gains from the food, it'll soon find something more profitable to eat. The pines use pitch to catch the insects who puncture their bark. The raspberries fend off herbivores with thorns. Nicotiana, the tobacco plant, deploys its toxic nicotine from spiky hairs that defend its leaves. My oak, in addition to its chemical and mechanical defenses, may also be part of a community action group that fights germs together. A plant that's bitten or infected releases a burst of special chemicals into the air. If my oak can detect a fellow oak's distress signals, then it will take heed and harden its own defenses. Should the plague of fungi or caterpillars attack anyway, my oak may issue a different chemical bulletin, a soups on alert to lure the attacker's own predators. That's pretty clever for a big stick. Most experiments on talking trees have been conducted on small, manageable plants like tobacco and sage. but researchers increasingly suspect that many plants can smell when their neighbors are battling bugs and react to protect themselves. In one of the few experiments with trees in the open air, researchers played the role of herbivore in a stand of European black alders. They ripped leaves off some trees, which theoretically stimulated the alders to let out a chemical yell. Researchers then monitored the amount of natural attack borne by neighboring alders, whose leaves were not ripped. The trees nearest the wounded alders experienced the least gnawing by bugs. Presumably, they were able to detect the chemical yell and pumped their own leaves full of defense chemicals. Experiments with smaller plants have demonstrated all of these steps. A torn sage plant releases a burst of methyl jasminate. A tomato or a tobacco plant downwind from the injured sage plant boosts its own defense chemicals, and those downwind plants save themselves from herbivore attack. Plants can be surprisingly sophisticated with their shouting. In one field trial with tobacco plants, researchers set tobacco budworms on some plants and corn earworms on another. Each herbivore solicited a different mix of 12 chemicals from the plant it bit. Right on cue, a species of parasitic wasp that preys on budworms showed up, and those wasps flew to the budworm-infested plants. In experimenting with the yell chemicals, scientists have noticed that wild tobacco also seems to release a nighttime burst of repellent as a matter of normal hygiene. It appears to prevent moths from laying eggs on them. The combined effect of a plant's chemistry set is impressive. In one study, scientists calculated that a plant rebuffed over 90% of possible insect attacks. Plants may even communicate about bacterial infections. Many, when their leaves are injured, flood their tissues with a blast of oxygen to burn invading microorganisms. But they also released a cloud of antibiotic vapor into the air. Scientists haven't determined if nearby plants take the vapor as a warning. It's a new field of research, and the uncertainties are large, which is why I can't be sure whether my oak tree is a communicative genius or a stupid log. It seems likely, though, that the air around me is rife with chemical telegrams. It doesn't seem far-fetched that one insect's saliva chemical could induce one chemical reaction from my oak tree, and a different saliva chemical could elicit a different reaction. My own immune system does something similar. Nor does it seem amazing that a predatory wasp could evolve to perk up when she smells a certain distress chemical emanating from an oak leaf. So my trees are not helpless. They're armed to the teeth, and they have a lot more time to reproduce than their insect enemies have. If they're healthy, they can even weather the loss of an entire set of leaves to gypsy moth caterpillars. And sometimes it comes to that. In the evolution arms race, my oak tree has won some battles, but the war never ends. Mutations happen. Sometimes the mutation hands the tree a new defense. Other times it bestows a new tool on an herbivore. An herbivorous gypsy moth is currently one mutation ahead of the oak tree. Some years ago, when I lived in an oaky neighborhood, the gypsy moth caterpillars had a boom year. They wiggled in platoons across the driveway and up the trunk of the tree by my house, and they ate. The trees they'd ravaged on the other side of the driveway held up leaf skeletons against the blue sky. The leaves on my tree were soon converted to caterpillar meat and to frass, which pelted down in brown nuggets to cover the house, the car, and the lawn. The snicking of caterpillar jaws was audible. When my tree was eaten back to gray twigs, the caterpillars moved on. What gives? Shouldn't a gypsy moth starve when it spends all its energy eating inedible tannins? Scientists don't know exactly what method the caterpillars use to prevent tannins from binding up every shred of nutrition in an oak leaf. Whatever it is, it's not yet perfect. Gypsy moths that feed on oak trees grow more slowly than their kinfolk who eat other plants. But Jack Schultz, from a research team at Penn State, told me he thinks the caterpillars have found two ways to defang tannins. One, the larvae keep their guts unusually well oxidized, which makes the tannins stick to each other rather than to proteins. Two, the tannins also get stuck to fat molecules in the larvae's gut. While this deprives the caterpillars of some fat, it does permit other nutrients to be absorbed. Other acorn eaters have out-mutated the oak, too. Squirrels have evolved to eat only the least tannic part of the acorn. If nuts are plentiful, they'll bite off the top and leave the rest. Deer have evolved special spit that combats tannins. Humans have too, my oak leaf aversion notwithstanding. In my saliva, special proteins bind up the tannins and escort them through my body, which prevent them from hijacking the acorn protein. It's only logical that we would have evolved coping skills, since tannins are so common in the plant world and since plants are so common in the human diet. To manage the super tannic acorn, though, humanity has relied on technology. Many American Indian populations pounded acorns into flour, then soaked out the tannin. Sometimes an animal who defeats a plant's chemical defense evolves further to exploit those chemicals for its own use. The monarch butterfly is one. The monarch caterpillar eats the heart poisons from the milkweed plant, then sequesters them in his body, which makes him taste terrible to birds. Like many creatures, the monarch publicizes a foul flavor with bright colors as if to say, "If I'm this easy to see, there's probably a catch." The viceroy butterfly, an evolutionary cheater, mimics the monarch's colors and forgoes the bitter diet. The tobacco hornworm does likewise with the toxic atropine in tobacco. Instead of succumbing to atropine poisoning, the green giant stores it inside to repel her own enemies. And the gypsy moth researchers at Penn State say that gypsy moth caterpillars can self-medicate with oak tannins to protect themselves from the deadly wilt disease virus. They dose themselves with the same chemical intended to send them packing. Even we humans are appropriating the oak's intellectual property and testing tannins for antiviral properties. This year my oak escaped major plagues. I'm not sure why, because the oaks in a park a few blocks away were ravaged by a horde of oak skeletonizers. Tiny moth larvae are currently descending from those treetops on threads of silk, heading for a winter in the duff. They tangle in such profusion that the edge of the oak stand glistens like a curtain. From my tree, only a couple of streamers wave. The leaves are dark, still hauling in sunlight. I can't prove it, but my personal theory is that my tree has a good nose for trouble. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.